accession number 28624, reel 9.
It has just been a wonderful experience, but as you can imagine, a small island, the job was repetitive. To have stayed there longer wouldn't have sharpened you up or improved your soldiering. It was time really to get back. 3 months was just perfect. You were doing a good job, but it was repetitive, and getting back to Kenya. So I was sorry to leave, but looking forward to Kenya.
And was the journey back just the opposite of how you'd arrived there?
Absolutely. The new company arrived, and we said hello and goodbye in a very short space of time. We got onto the same ferry that took us from Zanzibar to Mombasa, and then the same train journey, except in reverse.
And I wondered, actually, after hearing the last train journey, was there any threat, you know, in Kenya? Was there any threat there?
No. There really wasn't. The Mama had happened. The Mama emergency had ended about 7 years earlier, and there was no need for political threats because there was already a program in place for Uhuru, as it was known, independence. Jomo Kenyatta was going to be the new president of an independent nation. The governor, who his name will come to me in a moment, was already programmed to be the last British governor of what was then a colony. You know, so there was absolutely, and there was no political requirement for menace or threat, because there was nothing that they didn't already have. You know, they were going to get independence, there was a day fixed for it. So there was nothing to threaten the military with, no reason at all. It was a very peaceful time up there. We were only stationed in Kenya at that point for a rail somewhere else, you know, the Kuwaiti rail. So, no threat at all.
Good morning. It's session 5 and it's with Mr. Kinghorn. Last time we spoke about when you were in Zanzibar and then you had just returned. You were actually just returning to Kenya when we finished the last one. I realise you hadn't been in the camp much, so can you describe the camp that you were sent to?
Yes, I certainly can. It was a really just a put-together place, but we, as a battalion under Colonel Charles Napier, he was determined to make the camp as attractive as he could, and the battalion did set to. It was really a terrible little place. Well, it wasn't little, but it was quite sprawling, really, but the huts were spread out. They were old-fashioned huts. There were no two-story anything anywhere. They were all single-story huts. But by the time we got back, a lot of work had been done on it. The roadway was good, the main roadway. There were little footpaths. Grass had been sown and growing beautifully. Flowers, all that sort of thing. The place had been transformed, and it was becoming a good-looking place. But it was of low quality. I mean, there was nothing you could do about the accommodation except live in it.
And which year approximately was that?
That was 1962. We got back. We were in Zanzibar, that is B Company, were sort of middle of the year. So we would have got back sometime after the middle of 62 to Gilgil in Kenya, 75 miles from Nairobi up the Rift Valley.
And these huts that you were they wooden huts or?
Yes, they were. That's precisely what they were. Yeah, but they'd been painted, so they looked a lot better. The whole place looked all right.
And was it an army colour they were painted in?
No, I if I had to remember, I would. So, I mean, it was a mixture of the white, blue. No, it wasn't a camouflage colour at all. No, just made to look attractive.
Okay. And now that you were an officer as well, how many men had you to share your accommodation with?
Well, I lived in the officers' mess, and there were we were just over 30, I think, strong. There were about 18 subalterns, and then their captains, majors, and the commanding officer, of course. We also had a Royal Army Education Officer, we had a medical officer, we had a dentist, and we had the chaplain, Bill Wright. So we were just over 30, about 32, 33 officers, I think.
And did you have a room to yourself?
Yes, had a little room to myself. The huts accommodated about six or eight, with communal showers in another hut. Built around a little sort of garden area, courtyard you call it, but there was a bit of lawn there, and we were a complete square of huts around it for the accommodation. Then there was the main mess hut, which was our anteroom and dining room.
And did you have a batman looking after you there?
Yes, I did. Looking after is a term not necessarily to be used. I mean, he would come along when we were in camp, and I have to say we were not in barracks very much. We were out nearly all the time in manoeuvres, but if we were in barracks, he would come along in the evening for whatever was necessary, half an hour maybe, that would be all, to clean some kit, the sporran, the sand brown, that sort of thing. But we weren't in barracks very much.
Okay, so when you were there, did you have to look after the remainder of your kit yourself?
No, like everyone else in the battalion, there was a dobie service, it was called a laundry, and you just, on two appointed days a week, you put in your khaki drill shorts or slacks or whatever, shirts, the whole lot, socks, they all went in, came out same day or next day. But that was all done by a local contractor who employed a mixture of African and Asian people who provided this service under contract to the War Office, as it was then, Ministry of Defence now.
Okay, so you didn't pay them?
No, not at all. No, this was a military contract, and this applied to jocks, everyone else. The service was there for everybody.
And what about your bedding? Did they clean that as well?
Bedding, yes, I think from memory, the pillow slips and sheets were, and that's all there was really, were done on a weekly basis. I could be wrong about that, but that was part of the same contract.
And did you sleep under mosquito nets there?
Yes, we certainly did, and you needed to. The place was alive with mosquitoes, and only needs one, but the one came along with many friends, so we did get under our mosquito nets every time we were there sleeping. And it was necessary, because it was a real threat. I mean, muster parade each day in barracks, or even if you were out in manoeuvres, there was a parade whereby you took your anti-malaria pill, which was, I forget the name of it, anyway, everyone had to take one every day. If you interrupted the course, you lost the effect of the build-up of this particular drug. So we took that pill each day, religiously, and we also slept under mosquito nets, because that was a degree of comfort, but B, it was necessary.
And to keep the huts cool, was there fans or anything in them?
No, there were no fans. I mean, what you would do is simply sleep with your window open, which would cool the place down a little in summer, but not all that much. The most I remember about fans was the Nafi sold something that looked like a torch, and instead of a light at the end of it, the battery's actually got a little propeller turning, and I think perhaps for the first two or three days of our tour out there, we all bought one of these and thought this would help. And then we put them aside because they didn't really help much. No fans, no air conditioning, just windows open.
And did you get any other pests in the accommodation, you know, with having windows open?
Yeah, I think the only other pest I can remember in barracks was really mosquitoes at night and flies during the day. I mean, thousands of them. And but, you know, that was just something you had to live with. I mean, we didn't bother flitting the place or spraying or anything. I mean, the flies disappeared in the evening when the mosquitoes came out, so we just lived with theirs. And really, it didn't seem to be much of a problem. They were just there.
And was this camp surrounded by anything? Was it surrounded by fencing or anything?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was a properly secure camp with fencing, and that was necessary. Not insofar as there would be any invasion of any description, but I mean, thieving would have taken place had, as I say, you know, windows were open everywhere, and thieving would have taken place. Had you not had the security of a high fence and a guard patrol during the night. So that was in place all the time.
And was it a big camp?
Yes, it was, yeah. It was well spread out. The company lines were quite a walk from each other. For example, the front gate to the battalion headquarters, the orderly room, would have been perhaps only 60 yards, but then from there you would walk to any of the three companies would be a good 150 yards away, something like that from memory. The mess from the orderly room was not far at all, 40 yards or so, but it was well spread out. And then beyond that, actually that was outside. I was going to talk about things like the assault course and so on, and the playing fields, but they were all outside the actual fenced camp, so they don't count at all. But it was spread out, yes, it's quite a large camp.
And how many men approximately would have been there?
Well, those were the days with national service, so not that the conscription had come to an end, but we still had the residue. There were still national servicemen there. We'd had a very successful recruiting campaign before we went out to Kenya, and large numbers were recruited, so the battalion was at full strength plus. And I have a recollection that we had between 750 and 800 in the first half of Kenya. By then, of course, we were losing the national servicemen who weren't being replaced, and in the normal way you have wastage and lose people who have come to the end of their service, perhaps, but they're being replaced by new recruits. But we were a strong battalion then.
And were there any families in amongst all these people in the camp?
No, the the quarters were not too far away. Most of the quarters were about, and again, memory comes into play here, about a mile and a half away was the quarters. Remembering that it was a very large military base, Gilgil. I mean, we had a full regiment of the 3 Royal Horse Artillery, and we had a squadron of Royal Engineers, and there might have been more. So all those people had to be quartered, and the quarters were up beside the sort of main Nafi area, which was a sort of superstore, really, a supermarket type place where everyone got their supplies. But that was a very large quartering area, and if that didn't accommodate everyone, and it mostly did, our nearest town was Nakuru. And there were what's known as hirings there. That was about 20 miles away. There were some hirings which meant accommodation that the Ministry of Defence didn't own but rented for married families to live in. But the main quartering area was about a mile and a half from memory away.
And so was the Gordon Highlander section, was that just one section in like a far larger area that had troops in it?
Yes. Our camp was one camp, and then the other two I mentioned were about a mile away. It was a spread out system. I mean, we had the little town, or rather big village of Gilgil itself, was the center point. We were, our camp was on at one end, on one side of it, the quarters about another mile away at the same end, and then at the other side of Gilgil were certainly the Royal Engineers and the Royal Horse Artillery.
And what type of village was Gilgil?
It was just a one-horse town. Honestly, something you might see in a Western film. It was just one main street and very little else, with two or three little shops and a car hire place, I remember, which we used. Two or three little shops, which we hardly used because the Natty was the main supplier of the sort of things we wanted. There was a cafe. There was certainly a bar there called the White Heather Bar, I think. Really, it was, that would have been owned by an Asian, no doubt, who would have changed its name doubtless to attract the jocks. And probably as soon as we left and someone else came, the pub changed its name again. And that's about all there were. And then some, it really was a bit of a shanty town, the not very attractive living accommodation for the local Africans there. It was a tiny little place.
And did you ever go into this, say, White Heather Club?
I did once. It wasn't a particularly nice place. There were one or two other places there you could go to which served food as well as being a bar. And we patronised those, but there was nothing really desperately attractive about any of them. When we wanted, and it meant taking a car, when we wanted to enjoy a drink outside camp, which of course is something you always want to do because you're in camp so much, there was a place called Naivasha, on Lake Naivasha, which had a nice little hotel and bar, and we went there, and Nakuru was about 20 miles away. And that was quite a sizable town, and it had a number of places, including the Rift Valley Club. There were hotels, there were bars. And those were two attractive places to go to. Gilgil was not attractive at all.
Okay. And you've spoken about the Gordon Highlanders section as well. How did they guard it? Was there a guard through the night and through the day?
But through the day, yes, your own proper police who man the guardroom look after it, the proper sergeant, that's the regimental police sergeant, as opposed to military police, these are our own people, would have his own section of regimental police, and they were responsible for looking after it. At night, you mounted a guard. The duty company that week would provide all sorts of, they would look after all the duties. Perhaps there was a cookhouse requirement or a cleaning requirement, anything that was required, duty company would provide. And you were duty company for 1 week. And duty company also mounted the guard each night for that week. The company sergeant major would detail those who were to be on guard, and they would take over the guardroom from the regimental police, and that I think happened at 6 o'clock in the evening, and they would only be relieved at 6 o'clock the next morning. So it was a 12-hour shift.
And were the officers of the duty section, were they involved in this as well?
No, the officers didn't come from the duty company. The adjutant detailed the orderly officer, and the RSN detailed the duty sergeant, orderly sergeant, for the day and for that night. It was a 24-hour duty, and They were dealt with, therefore, from the orderly room. So any subaltern might be orderly officer that day and night. It certainly had nothing to do with who was duty company.
Okay. And when we were speaking about, you know, your accommodation as well, were you still being inspected, or are officers inspected?
Yes, they most certainly are. They, you know, not on a daily basis, but I mean, officers, when they are on a muster parade, say, which you do in companies, it's not a regimental, it's not a battalion thing, it's a company thing. You know, an officer, subaltern, is there inspecting his platoon, but at the same time, you know, the company commander will be casting an eye over the subalterns, and if they're not up to scratch, then they'd be told so. Apart from that, formal inspections took place in the form that an adjutant could call an adjutant's parade any time he wanted to, and those were done, and we had subaltern's drill, which would begin with an inspection of the subalterns by the adjutant to see that they were properly turned out. And these wouldn't happen on a daily basis, nothing like it, but they would happen occasionally. As far as your room was concerned, again, the adjutant would be decide that it was time to check the rooms. And a day would be appointed. And this would happen again any occasion. And the day would be appointed, and you would be at your room when he came round. He would just look at it, make sure that everything was clean, tidy, and move on, assuming everything was clean and tidy.
And at that level, do you remember if you were ever disciplined because maybe your room wasn't properly...
Never for the room, but certainly, oh yes, I mean, on adjutant's inspection, you know, it's always possible to find a blemish somewhere at the back of one's sporran, or your kilt pin isn't glinting in the sun. So on a number of occasions, on a subaltern's parade, someone would be hauled up because his standard of turnout was less than that desired, and he would receive some sort of award of extra orderly officers or whatever was required.
And when you were out being inspected, whether it be like a muster parade or another one, and you maybe had on the kilt, what did you wear with the kilt in, you know, the heat that was out there?
Well, the standard dress around camp, if it was kilt, would be, starting from bottom down, Shoes Highland, which we all know as brogues, your Lovett hose and flashes, skin do. Then with a kilt, it would be the leather purse, the leather sporran. Shirt sleeve order always, so that was sort of khaki drill shirt with shirt sleeves, no tie, and your TOS, your Tam O'Shanter, with badge, of course, and that was standard, fairly simple stuff. Oh, I beg your pardon, and a Sam Brown belt to over your shirt.
And the accommodation there as well, did you have plenty of shower facilities?
Yes, we certainly did. You know, had on the occasion, and there were only occasions when we were in time. Battalion was in, all companies were in. There was usually certainly one out, if not two out, on company training manoeuvres. You know, there might have been a bit of a wait for a shower. I can't remember how many there were, but by and large, you know, you all shower several times. I mean, at different times before, from the end of duties for the day and going into the mess for supper in the evening. I mean, some people would be listening to their radio, some would be out for a run, whatever. So you weren't all queuing up at the same time. So the accommodation was okay from that point of view.
And was the toilet facilities, were they up to like a Western standard? Or?
Yes, they were. Yeah, absolutely, they were. They were our sort of facilities. Yeah.
Okay. And you mentioned radio as well. Was there a British broadcasting unit or something out there?
Yes, there was. Forces Radio, which, you know, in those days certainly followed garrisons around the world. And it came from Nairobi, and it was the British Forces Broadcasting Service. And they would bring you up to date with news. It wasn't on all day. It was on, you know, just at these precise times when you might be able to listen to a radio. But it would play the sort of pop songs of the day and give local news from Nairobi and news from the UK, that sort of thing. And then they did a Sunday lunchtime request program, that sort of thing. But I forget how long, but it would have been about an hour, certainly an hour a day or an hour and a half a day, and that would be in the evening. And then at the weekend, they would provide something at a different time.
Was there any television out there at that point?
No television, no. Absolutely not. There may have been in Nairobi, but certainly I doubt even if there was then. I'm not aware of any television, certainly none with us.
And what about power cuts? Did you have your own generators there, or were you just on the normal electricity?
We might have had a generator for a standby, a contingency, but I think we were probably on the Kenyan grid, yes. I can't remember power cuts, I have to say. It seemed to work. Yeah.
Okay. And how would you have described the general health of the men who were out there with the heat and the threat of mosquitoes and
it was pretty good. I suppose the main thing were the usual things that come with heat and the wearing of fairly heavy equipment, and that is rashes of the skin, which is the rubbing of the equipment together with a sort of excessive sweat that takes place, and the rashes would come, but everyone knew how to attend to those matters themselves because everyone suffered from it. Blisters, of course, was another thing because socks that were sweaty would lose their shape and they'd rub and cause abrasions in the feet. Athlete's foot was a very common one too. And there's nothing much you can do about that except wash your feet, but on a very regular basis. But of course, when you were out and about, you couldn't do that. So that was one that had to be taken care of. I must say also that the sun, a number of people, the fairer skinned, the redheads and the blonde fellows, they did suffer. And yet the remarkable thing is, I remember one huge exercise up in the Northern Frontier District when we were manoeuvring with the entire brigade and the African forces, the King's African Rifles, whichever particular regiment it was of them. They actually suffered more heat casualties than we did, but I do remember some pretty severe blistered cases, not of the feet, but of the lips and around the ears and the face that some of the jocks had to endure. But nevertheless, they didn't leave the exercise, but there were far more King's African Rifles who suffered from heat exhaustion than we did. So generally the health was pretty good, but inevitably the sun does get you.
And was there any special cream or anything they could put on these blisters?
I suppose there was, but I'm not aware of it. And in those days, people really didn't look after themselves all that well. No one wore sun cream or anything like that. Anyway, you wouldn't want to carry it. Now, I think, you know, once you'd suffered, you did your best to deal with it. But, you know, rashes are quickly healed once you get the opportunity to shower and wash on a regular basis and...